Next, I would like to introduce Dr. Michael Kelly. Mike was already working on getting hepatitis B vaccination for inmates in the Texas prisons when I started in the Division of Viral Hepatitis almost 9 years ago. So this is a very long-standing project. He is the Director of Preventive Medicine at the Texas Department of Criminal Justice for the last 11 years, prior to which he was the Prevention Branch Chief for Communicable Disease Control for the state of Texas. So he comes from an infectious diseases and preventive medicine background. And I'll turn it over to Mike to talk about hepatitis B vaccination in the Texas Department of Criminal Justice.
Good afternoon. It's really gratifying to see so many people sticking it out till the end of the day like this. I am assuming that y'all are public health people and you might not know a whole lot about corrections, so I just wanted to take a few minutes to talk about our system. The first thing I'd like to do is differentiate between a prison and a jail. Several years ago, we had a CDC public health advisor assigned to our prison system, and he just drove me crazy because it took me about a week. Took me about a year to get him to stop calling our facilities jails. But at least in Texas, jails are run by local government. They are a city jail under the police department or a county jail operated by the sheriff's department. The jails will house not only incarcerated offenders, incarceration is what happens after you're convicted of a crime, but they also detain individuals, people who have been booked and charged with a crime but are awaiting their trial. They characteristically have a very rapid turnover. In fact, in our jails, at least 70% of the people who are booked in are released within 2 weeks. The people serving time in jail are either waiting to come to prison or they're serving time for relatively minor misdemeanor offenses. On the other hand, the prison is a state agency. All of our offenders are incarcerated, that is, they're convicted felons. They have longer sentences. And although our turnover is lower, we still have about 70,000 intakes a year, which is a lot of people to be dealing with. Of course, we like to confuse this because we have several types of facilities in the Texas Department of Criminal Justice, and we also do a lot of community supervision. We have about 450,000 offenders on parole. Somebody on parole is a person who has served some time for their sentence, they're released early, but they remain under community supervision until their sentence runs out. The parole division also operates four intermediate section facilities. Technically speaking, the folks in these ISFs are still on parole, but they are back in custody. And those guys are then back into our healthcare system, whereas the ones in the community are not within our healthcare system. The ISFs are for people who are threatening to get their parole revoked, and they're just trying to shake a little sense into them before they get revoked and get sent back to prison. So they have pretty short stays, 30 to 90 days. We also operate Safe Peace substance abuse felony programs. These are programs for people who have been convicted of a felony, but their criminal behavior seems to be related to their drug abuse. And so they're sentenced to substance abuse treatment rather than just to serve their time. But they're only with us for 6 months, which creates some of the same challenges you see in a jail. And then to make it really confusing, we have state jails, which these are for felons, but they are for the least serious kinds of offenses. And they can have up to a 2-year sentence. Shortest sentence will be 3 months. And the typical length of stay is about 8 or 9 months. And then our state prisons is the majority of our prisoners. We have a capacity problem, so we also contract out with jails and private facilities to hold some of our inmates. The ones that are in contract beds are also outside of our healthcare system because it's a package deal. We just pay for keeping them, feeding them, and taking care of them when they're not in our system. Well, as of the end of February, we had just over 155,000 offenders in our system, which makes us, we go back and forth between one, two, or three in the country. We're always battling out with the Federal Bureau of Prisons in California for who has the largest system. And it puts us probably in the top 10 or 12 systems in the world. Most of our inmates are in prison for the longer term. They're serving average sentences of around 7 or 8 years. About 25,000 in our state jails, and then the rest you can see there. Overwhelmingly, prisoners are males, 92% in our system. Racial and ethnic breakdown, it's about equal when you look at the numbers of offenders. Of course, the African Americans are tremendously overrepresented in our system compared to the community, whereas the white and Hispanic populations are underrepresented. Average age of 37 is going up, and they're not all dim bulbs, but the average IQ is 90, a little bit less than average, and their educational achievement average is 8th grade, so education can be a challenge with these folks. And the recidivism rate, actually ours I think is a little lower than what's published, but 28% in 3 years. So a good portion of them come back to us once we let them out. This, people often think of prisons or jails as bars and razor wire, and we have that, but we also have a lot of chain link fence. This is a tank. This is a holding area. This particular one is at our tank or cage, we call it. It's at one of our intake facilities, and this is where some inmates would be put temporarily while they're being screened or processed in there. 10 to 15 offenders in there for several hours. What I've got this up here for is to show you that one of the first things you lose when you go to prison is any sense or expectation of privacy, if you notice the toilet right there at the front of the cell. This is a typical cell, two-man cell. There's some personal property in there. The offenders can have property, although they're pretty limited as to what they can have. Most of our inmates, though, are in dormitories, and this isn't a really good example of a dormitory. This is a 18-man dormitory. There's three little cages in there with six bunks in each one. Most of our dormitories are more of an open bay design, and we'll have anywhere from 50 to 75 offenders in one of our dormitories. Okay, well, so much for our system. I guess from a prison perspective, one of our questions has to be, why vaccinate prisoners? And to a public health audience, probably, why even ask that question? I mean, of course you vaccinate prisoners. They're high-risk people. But look at it from the perspective of a prison administrator. Their mission is public safety and to keep people locked up and hopefully some rehabilitation and reintegrate them back into community and keep them from coming back. But healthcare is not their mission. So they may not see this as something that they should be involved with. So how do I convince my boss that we should have vaccination in the prison? I could take an approach, well, this is a high-risk group, and that's pretty easy to prove. I can point to the burden of disease. 1.3% of our offenders have chronic hepatitis B. That's about 10 times higher than what we found when I was with the health department and EMS workers in Central Texas, and that's a group certainly we think should be vaccinated. It's pretty easy to argue that our inmates practice high-risk behaviors when they can get away with it, whether they're in prison or out in the community. Argue that it's a standard of care. That's a little tougher because, yeah, there's some guidelines out there saying we should vaccinate prisoners, but when my boss looks at the other systems around the country, less than half of them are doing it. So no, I don't think that's a standard of care in prisons yet. And even worse, when we compare what maybe private practitioners are doing with their high-risk patients, maybe it's not really, has not become established as a standard of care in a private medical practice, because I don't think their vaccination rates are too good either. How about an efficient public health measure? And Cindy said 40% of acute hepatitis B has a history of incarceration. The paper I looked at said 1/3, but a lot of the acute cases that we're getting now, had they been vaccinated when they were incarcerated, maybe we wouldn't have those cases. And then we could also try the economic argument that our prison will save money by vaccinating their inmates. And I'll get back to that in just a little bit. Prisoner vaccination is clearly effective. Now, I can't find much literature on vaccination programs in correctional facilities in the United States, because there's not anything published, really. But in Great Britain, there has been some work, because they had their drive to increase the vaccination rate among injection drug users. And one of their approaches was to start vaccinating in their prisons. So there are several articles about the outcome of their efforts over there. For example, in Scotland in 1999, they started vaccinating in their prisons, and they had been doing serosurveys in their injection drug users, or actually not serosurveys, these were interviews in their injection drug users since 1994. 19% of their drug users were vaccinated, as opposed to 52% 2 years after they started prison vaccination. And of those that were vaccinated in 2001, most of them, over half of them, had been vaccinated in prison. Another study, they looked at women coming into prison in England to see, of those who were vaccinated, what were the independent predictors that they would have been vaccinated. There was a weak association with being an injection drug user, but a very strong association. A woman who had previously been incarcerated was 12 times more likely to be vaccinated than a woman who had not been incarcerated previously. And then another study, they interviewed injection drug users who were in the community, and of those who were vaccinated, the largest group were people who got vaccinated in prison. So I think pretty clearly a prison or a jail is a good place to catch people who need to be vaccinated. So who's doing it in the United States? I guess now I should put Massachusetts on this list. This is not a scientifically derived list. It's just me and Betty Gondels, who's closely associated with American Correctional Association and a real advocate of inmate vaccination. We just came up with who we knew were doing hepatitis B vaccination. But it's only 14 out of 50, 51 if you include Federal Bureau of Prisons. So it's about 25%, which agrees with what Dr. Weinbaum said. Okay, let's get back to that economic rationale. Is it going to save money for our prison system if we vaccinate against hepatitis B? I think the answer is no. This is something that we would be doing to save money for the community as a whole, not for our system. One model looked at what it would take, what conditions would we have to make vaccinating against hepatitis B a cost saving to our system. And they concluded that if nobody was immune to hepatitis B when they came into the system, and the cost of vaccine was less than $30 a dose, then it would be cost saving to the system. And actually, there's an interaction between the prevalence of seromarkers for hepatitis B and the cost of vaccine. So there are more conditions than just what I have listed up here that could make it cost effective. And in fact, in TDCJ, are the prevalence that we found in 99, when we did a seroprevalence study, that about 25% of our incoming inmates had evidence of prior infection or vaccination. And our vaccine dose is much lower than $30 a dose. We're getting it, well, let me just say that right now we wouldn't want to buy it at the Public Health Service price. We got a good deal this year. And if you use those two criteria, according to this model, the was published, it would be cost savings for us to do it. The problem with the model is that their baseline assumptions were that there was a 1% annual incidence of acute hepatitis B in the system and 7% after release. And that data, their references for using that assumption come from some studies that were done in the early 1980s in, I think, the New Mexico prison system. And I can tell you, in the 1980s, our system was completely different than it is now. And I could believe that the incidence of Hep B was up there then. At that time, we had building tenders, which are inmates that basically run the prison. And the environment and what people did in prison, it was a much wilder place. But so that's the problem, though, that assumption of 1% annual incidence is much, much higher than what we actually see. In our system, we're getting 5 to 17 cases per 100,000 per year, which, yeah, that's probably low. And I wouldn't argue if somebody said it was 10 times higher than that, although I doubt that it is. But for us to have 1% annual incidence, it would have to be 60 to 200 times higher than what we're seeing, and I know we're not that far off. And actually, if a case isn't diagnosed and reported and treated, it doesn't cost us anything, so would it count into that cost-benefit calculation anyhow? Well, let's assume that a prison system does decide to undertake vaccination. There are some things that I think they would have to consider. And one of the most important is probably whether they would screen before vaccination. Again, in the community, it's a no-brainer. You don't do that. That's just a barrier to vaccination and probably not going to save you money. But in the prison, our patients are much more likely to not need vaccination, and maybe it's going to be worthwhile. So we could take three approaches. We could choose to just vaccinate everybody, or we could screen and give the first dose of vaccine at the same time, or we could screen and we could wait for the results and then decide to vaccinate or not based on the results of the screening test. Another issue is the tracking. Mary talked about how one unit they got 130 intakes, was it a day or a month?
A day.
A day, and 130 leaving a day. Well, the population is more stable in a prison, but even so, we still have about 2,000 inmates on the move every day going from one place to another. And at 70,000 intakes a year, that means almost half of our population turns over in a year's time. In addition, we have 112 units with 800 miles between the two most far apart, east to west, and 800 miles north to south distance separating them. So keeping track of offenders and deciding, knowing when they need their next dose as they go from one unit to another is problematic in a system like ours, even with our more stable population. And then with some of the short stays, are you going to use a standard 0, 1, and 6 month schedule, or are you going to use a non-standard schedule to administer the doses closer together and have more people complete the series? And then something that I don't think has been accounted for in these models of the value of vaccinating in prison is the effectiveness of the vaccine. We, I think, assume that it's going to be as effective as it is in anybody else. But prisoners have a lot of comorbidity, a lot of drug addiction, prior drug use, high prevalence of hepatitis C, HIV, end-stage renal disease, diabetes, and physiologically, they're just older than what their chronological age is. Our chronological age may average 37, but I'll bet physiologically the average age is more like 47, 50-year-old population because of the comorbidity. And the vaccine just may not be as effective in that group. If you're going to screen, there's a further question to consider, and that is, what do you screen for? I am assuming that if screening's worthwhile, it's probably only going to be worthwhile if you screen using a single serum marker, not doing the whole panel. So the two that you'd choose from, are you going to do anti-core antibody or are you going to do anti-surface antibody? Advantage of the core antibody is that it'll be there if somebody has chronic hep B, and supposedly if somebody has been infected and gotten over it many, many years ago, the core antibody will be more persistent and may be there when surface antibody is no longer detectable. So people who have naturally been infected will probably be more efficiently detected by using core antibody. The limitation of core antibody, of course, is vaccine doesn't elicit core antibodies, so people who've been vaccinated won't show up using that screening test. So surface antibody, of course, would be better if you got a high prevalence of prior vaccination. Well, in 1999, we did a seroprevalence study on offenders coming into the system, and 5.5% of them had evidence of prior vaccination. They were surface antibody positive, core antibody negative. And then when we were starting up this time, I did a more of a convenient study, just used one unit, but about 400 or 500 consecutive intakes at the unit. This time it was 9.3% had evidence of prior vaccination. On the other hand, chronic hep B, overall in the population, it was 1.3%, but I only had the number from 1999. I didn't have that in 2007, so I only looked at those who are hep C or HIV positive. And there really wasn't much change, maybe a slight decrease in the prevalence of chronic hep B. But clearly, I think looking at these numbers, surface antibody is the serum marker that we would use for screening. If you're going to screen and you have to have a separate visit and draw blood, there's a lot more personnel time involved in doing screening. And so the break-even prevalence where screening is worthwhile requires a much higher level of prior infection or prior vaccination to make screening worthwhile. And in our system, if more than 25% of the population being screened has a positive antibody test, then dollars and cents wise, screening is going to be worthwhile before we vaccinate. But if you're already doing a blood test for some other reason, and the only cost is the incremental cost of adding another blood test for surface antibody, the break-even point is much lower. In our system, 7% prevalence of positive surface antibody would be all we need to make screening before we vaccinate worthwhile. This talk, Dr. Wanyama talked like we've been vaccinating since 2000, but really I should say this is the sequel, because we did it from 2000 to 2002, and then in 2002 we stopped vaccinating all of the offenders and went only to those that were HIV or hep C positive, and then in 2007 we started up again. So I want to say a little bit about what we did in 2000 to 2002 and then talk about what we're doing now. In 2000, there were several things that just came together at the right time that allowed us to get this. At that time, and now, our healthcare is it's a managed care system, and it's the healthcare providers are under contract from us, two of our university medical schools. And the contract's overseen by the Correctional Managed Healthcare Committee. And at that time, the chair of the committee was a former commissioner of health. He was a pediatrician by training, a vaccine advocate who had kicked off a huge and well-funded childhood vaccination program when he was the commissioner of health. So he was really pushing for it. He was well-respected by our legislature and a good spokesperson for us. Also, the National Institutes of Health had just had their consensus conference on hepatitis C, and they had published their report. So we were looking at how we were managing hepatitis C and kind of dismayed at how much it might cost us and how would we ever do all those liver biopsies, how could we ever buy all that interferon. But we wanted to do something about hepatitis C, and vaccination was something that made sense. Even though it didn't treat hepatitis C, there were people that should be vaccinated. So that was one of the things that we thought we could do at that time. Not to say that we weren't treating hepatitis C, but vaccine was up there towards the top of our list of new things that we would like to start. And just before the legislative session started, we had an expert panel to give us recommendations. And this panel included people like Rob Lierla and Hal Margolis from CDC. It had the current commissioner of health then, and the physician who chaired the NIH consensus conference. So it was a pretty high-powered panel, and their top recommendation was if we couldn't do anything else, we should at least vaccinate, something I was glad to hear. So that was about a month before our legislative session started, and the outcome was that the legislature set aside $10 million from our healthcare budget for vaccination for a two-year period. Set aside is an important word. They didn't put in $10 million more. They just said, out of money we've already appropriated to you, you will spend $10 million on vaccination. Now, me, I didn't care because that meant we could vaccinate, but of course our money counters just hate having any kind of restriction put on the budget. So, oh boy, I gotta move. Okay. Well, implementing this system at that time, we did not have a tracking system. We were on a paper system, and each unit had their own tracking system, so we needed something that would work system-wide. The only thing we had available was our prescription auto-renewal database, which would kick out a refill wherever the inmate was in our system. The problem with that database is that it could not handle a 0-1 and 6-month schedule. We had to go with 0, 2, and 4 months so that we could use the database. Right today, that probably wouldn't raise many eyebrows, but back then that was not a recommended schedule. It had been studied in kids, but not in adults. But we decided it was better to have something that would give us a greater likelihood of completing a series than to take a chance on using the standard series that would not we would have a lower completion rate. And we did not screen before vaccinating because we didn't think it would be cost effective at that time. When our program got up and running, we were giving 20,000 doses a month. We found that of those who were eligible, that is, didn't have any serum markers or history of vaccination, 75% were being offered the vaccine, and it was a higher percentage and our longer-term facilities. There was about a 20% refusal rate, which is about what we see no matter what we offer offenders. About 20% are gonna refuse it no matter what it is. And when we looked at those who were in the system for at least 4 months after they started the series, we had pretty reasonable completion rates. 96% in our long-term prisoners, our state jail inmates with the shorter stays, although these all stayed long enough, it was only 54% in the state jail facilities. But then in December of 2002, we stopped it. To say there's a lack of funding is not accurate. It's that the people in charge of the money no longer had to spend the money on vaccine, and we had some pretty urgent acute care needs, so we did not continue with our vaccination program. But then in 2007, we had a similar convergence of events. Our legislature was interested in starting up the vaccination. Our Correctional Managed Health Care Committee was interested again. And I think there was probably a little help from some of the manufacturers' lobbyists talking to our legislature. But the net result was we once again got a carve out in the budget. This time, it was about $3 million a year, which was closer to what we were actually spending back when we did it before. And we took into account refusal rates and completion rates. And I think that's plenty of money for us to be vaccinating in our system. Conditions were different, so we didn't just start up what we did before. We now have a statewide electronic medical record in that EMR. We can use reminders, so we could go back to the 0-1 and 6-month schedule. But we did decide to screen, at least for starting the series on our new intakes, and that was because we now have a state law that requires HIV testing on intake, so we're already drawing blood. We just need to add the surface antibody test, and so it's cost effective for us to screen on intakes. We're not screening on the on-hand offenders that we catch up on. We'll start them during their anniversary of incarceration, but since no blood is required to be drawn then, we aren't screening them. We're just going to offer the vaccine. I'll skip over the problems and go to the results. Well, we actually had a higher prevalence of surface antibody than I expected. What we are seeing now is 30% of the inmates coming in have a positive surface antibody. And we're doing an even better job of offering the vaccine. Almost 92% of those of the offenders coming into the system, they're either already immune or they do get offered vaccine. The refusal rate is about the same, but some of these refusals may be because they already know they've been vaccinated or they know they're immune. 20% of the first doses we gave turned out to be wasted. That they were given to people who were immune, but that's just a reflection that we allowed some of the systems to screen and vaccinate rather than screen and wait to vaccinate, because if they screen and vaccinate and they turn out to be immune, the doc only has to go back and discontinue the order for the vaccine on 30% of the offenders, where if they screen and wait, the doctor has to go in and order the vaccine on 60%. So it's more efficient for the doc to screen and vaccinate than to screen and wait. Of those who needed a second dose, it was only 75% got the second dose, and 45% got the third dose. This was of a cohort who came into the system in July of last year. I'm really disappointed in those completion rates, but we had a couple of problems. One, I found out that the reminders, when an offender goes from one unit to another, the reminders have to be deleted at the old unit and re-entered at the new unit. So there's an opportunity for loss of continuity. We also had this little hiccup called Hurricane Ike last September that took out our prisons, our hospital and specialty clinic. It also took out our EMR, so we lost all of our reminders. So actually, considering we lost our reminders, I thought we did okay. And that's just my data. Problems I've seen, we have some units with a very high refusal rate. We have other units that we can learn from that have zero refusals and 100% completion rates. Where people fell out was when they got consent and they didn't give the first dose at the same time. They had to come back for that, where they did the screening and waiting and then the people transferring between the units. Thanks for sticking in there. I'm sorry for going over.